This is Arrivals, stories of migration, transformation, and change. And today, we're bringing you a very special collaboration with our friends at KCRW's Unfictional, a story that we're calling Conspiracy, Not the Crime.
Yeah, my name is and I'm 67 years old. I ran a business. We built and sold welded aluminum yachts. People all over the world wanted our boats. We had a lot of eccentric clients, you know, that were very rich. You know, it was like living a millionaire's dream, really. And that was the saddest part of when I had finally to leave. Some young people, they came in, paid cash, and they would ask us to raise the water lines and tear out the interior. And even then, I was so naive that I didn't realize what they were doing until finally they delivered the boats back and there were marijuana seeds in the bilges. So it was clear that, you know, what was going on. In 1977, the DEA came barging in my office and handcuffed me and took me away. I spent the night in prison. I had never been in trouble with the law. I don't even remember having a parking ticket. I had to hire an attorney. I started getting ready for the trial, which would be in North Carolina. And as it turned out, the jury was out for 11 hours, and they convicted me of the conspiracy and not the crime. So I got 5 years and a $10,000 fine. But even then, you know, okay, and I figured I was young, you know, and in good shape, and, you know, I could do the 5 years without any problem. So I didn't worry about it. But then I heard that they were investigating me for some new super indictment. I was in Walker's K at the Marlin tournament. And my lawyer got hold of me on the ship-to-shore radio and told me I had been indicted. Racketeering charges and continuing criminal enterprise, these were the same statutes that the Justice Department used to break up the mafia. It was like a story of fiction. I felt like, you know, I should have been on the periphery of the whole situation, and yet the government had involved me in this as one of the central people in the indictment. I couldn't believe it.
I'm brother. It wasn't really a surprise because I knew that was going to happen. Okay? I knew it was just a matter of time. Maybe he wasn't really involved in the drug running aspect of that business, but of course he knew what was going on. He knew exactly what was going on. The judge decided they were just going to throw everybody, regardless of their part in it, big or small, he was going to lump them all together and throw the book at them.
I was now being subjected to almost 200 years of possibility of prison in the new indictment. The DEA was up for renewal of their budget, and we were going to be made examples of.
You know, his family, I'm sure, were devastated. You know, the kids were pretty young at the time.
I have a handicapped son who was 5 years old at the time, and I had an 8-year-old daughter and a wife.
They were separated at that point.
I was having trouble sleeping. I was my mother wanted me to see a psychiatrist. I mean, they drove me to the point of suicide.
I'm my sister. I came down to see very, very depressed. He was so thankful that I came to see him, but he seemed almost suicidal. I felt so bad for him, but I had never, ever saw him depressed like that. So about an hour later, a girlfriend of his comes by with her score of cocaine, and within a few minutes, was a completely different person, laughing and gregarious. And while just minutes before he was saying, "Don't leave me, I want you to stay, and I feel so alone," within after just a few snorts of cocaine, he's, "Well, thanks for coming. Good to see you. You can go now. I'll see you some other time," and couldn't wait for me to get out the door. It's a completely different person, severe mood swings.
At lunch one day at the trial, I went across the street to the federal building,
you know, in Miami.
I took out an application for a new passport, presented my passport, got a passport picture, and filled out all the information. I expected somebody to say something, but nobody said anything. I walked out of the federal building thinking, how crazy, you know, but maybe the government, one part of the government didn't know what the other one was doing, which has turned out to be what happened. 2 or 3 weeks later, my new passport arrived, and I never used that passport until the day I left the United States. My attorney stood up in court one day on a Thursday and told the judge that I had not paid him and he could not continue to represent me in the trial. The judge said, well, all right, the trial for me would not continue and that I would await until he got around to giving me a new trial all by myself, separate from the other defendants. The trial was in recess on a Friday, so I had Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to implement my scheme to leave the country. I left in November of 1979, and I felt like, you know, I could somehow be back in a fairly short amount of time, like 2 or 3 years. I never expected to be gone 31 years. I drove my car to one of the big marinas in Fort Lauderdale so that the police, when they found the car, I knew they'd find the car, they think I left the country in a boat. I went to the main entrance, took a taxi to the airport in Fort Lauderdale, got a plane to JFK in New York, and then spent the night near JFK. Went the next morning, purchased a one-way ticket for Ecuador, for Guayaquil. I couldn't believe I was doing it. I had to have a whole pitcher of Bloody Marys on the airplane, you know, to steel myself. It was like a gnawing feeling in the back of my jaw, you know. I mean, I just had to clench my teeth and do it. I figured once I was over Jamaica, the plane was going to go on to Ecuador. And I figured once I got to Ecuador, I was going to be free for at least a little while until they caught up with me. I remember the plane banked over the Statue of Liberty and all I could do was wave goodbye.
When we were young, you know, I looked up to him. He was president of the student council. He was manager of the high school baseball team. He was always dressed impeccably in the mornings. He would put on 2 or 3 different outfits before he was happy with the way he looked. I mean, totally, totally different than how he is now.
He became general manager of the company, the family's boat building company.
Back then, he was doing very well. Selling a lot of boats and, you know, making good money, you know, driving nice cars.
Until he started doing cocaine, and that was the end of that. In fact, I walked into our conference room, I remember, and I opened the door, and there's about 6 or 7 guys in there, including himself, you know, doing cocaine. Of course, they invited me to come in, and I don't want no part of that. Cocaine just makes you mean and nasty, and it was terrible. I think doing all the drugs that he's done over the years, it's still affecting him. I don't know anymore, really, but yeah.
I'm a bipolar, and at the time, I hadn't discovered any great cure for it, you know, so I was in a period of mania by the fact that I had escaped all this tyranny. So I was up. I was riding very high. My client that owned two of my yachts met me at the airport in Guayaquil and took me to a hotel. And I asked, you know, where I could get lost. He suggested that I go to Chile. Well, I didn't know anything about Chile except, you know, I had heard how repressive the regime of General Pinochet was, and so I was very reticent to go to Chile. They told me, no, please, General Pinochet will never give you back to the Americans. So that sounded pretty good. I wound up on Aero Peru. I made a flight to Santiago, Chile. Las muchachas de hoy en día. I got to the airport. I met a taxi cab driver outside. We drove down to a little town on the coast, a beach, called Orcon. And in Orcon, there was a nude beach. And all the hippies were down there cooking on the beach, you know, whatnot. So I couldn't believe that. You know, I thought, this is Chile where the government is so oppressive, you know, and I've heard of all these human rights violations and whatnot. And so I stayed there in Viña del Mar. I got up every day, I went running, but most of all, I went out, I went to the market, and I was very good there in Chile. I just had a pastime. After a while, I made arrangements to go out sword fishing. Captain of the boat never showed up. I went across the street to get a drink. They didn't understand what I wanted, so they called the drink mixer at the bar. And she spoke a little English. So she came down and she introduced herself, took my order. I saw her walking away and I went, well, she has a nice potito. That's how we met. From that time on, we were together. We had a son. We wanted him to go to a good school. The school required us to be married. So that's when we got married. I had no money. So it caused me a lot of financial hardship. My wife had been to New York when she was 17 years old. She had been in the drug business, and she said, well, I'm going to run some cocaine to the United States. You can either join me or not. I was against it, you know, but I really didn't have an option to economically survive. So I said, well, let me design how to hide the cocaine in the luggage, and I'll go with you. I had an alias. And we went, and I was scared. You know, I figured they'd have my false identification, and they'd catch me at the airport. But they didn't. So I kept coming and going to the United States, even twice a month. We started in about 91. First, the friends of my wife put us up at their apartment. Then we moved to an apartment of our own, and finally to the penthouse on 30th Street. I had been using heroin, not mainlining it, snorting it, but it was very addictive anyway.
Well, you know, I had seen him in New York. Okay, because, you know, he had that apartment, left him, you know, strung out on drugs in an empty apartment laying on the floor. Neighbors called the police, and they took him to the hospital. But at that point, they had no idea who he really was.
I was put into a halfway house in Brooklyn. That was in 2001.
And my dad called me up. I was actually living in upstate New York outside of Newburgh. And he called me and he said, is in a halfway house in New York.
can you go and get him and put him on an airplane? Take him to Kennedy, put him on an airplane. At that point, I didn't really want to get involved in it, okay? But I did that. I did it for my dad, really. The place that he was at was horrible, like a slump. He was a mess, you know? I mean, his hair hadn't been cut in I don't know how long. And I mean, he was wearing, you know, dirty clothes. He looked like he was a bum living on the street. I think I took him and we went to McDonald's to get something to eat, you know? And then I took him to the airport, put him on a flight back to Chile.
They apparently had taken my fingerprints at the hospital. The FBI showed up at the halfway house at 5 o'clock in the morning to arrest me.
They were on his trail. They missed him by about 2 weeks.
I had very little contact with everybody was really afraid to do anything that would make them complicit in harboring a fugitive in one way or another. I think it was somewhere around 2009 or 2010, I honestly don't remember, but I had a call from the American Embassy in Chile. They said that wanted to turn himself in, come back to the U.S., and give himself up. I was actually very surprised.
I mean, he was actually living on the street. He had no place to go. You know, he got a hold of me and said, I have nothing. I really want to come home, even if I have to go to jail. It's better than what I'm doing now. I contacted the U.S. Marshals in Miami, explained to them what he was looking to do. And they told me that the warrant had been quashed, that he could come back and he would be a free man.
Quote unquote, the warrant had been dismissed. So I was able to get in touch with my lawyer in Miami, my friend, and I said, have you ever heard of any such thing as the warrant being dismissed? And he said, no, I've never heard of anything like that. Sounds very suspicious to me.
And I thought it was extremely hard to believe after all of this time, but they explained that they really had no interest in
like old news, and they had bigger fish to fry.
And the Chilean government really didn't want to take care of him anymore, and they really needed the American Embassy to help and return to the U.S.
So that was the plan, but at that point, I think he was pretty strung out on drugs, on heroin. Not on any meds, and he was like a crazy person.
And I went to the U.S. Embassy and was processed.
Made a big production there, and they basically said that there's no way that they could put him on an airplane.
It took several months for the embassy to arrange the flight back.
He had to go into a hospital. Okay, they had to get him cleaned up and get him on the right meds, which they did, and that took several months.
Probably 8 months. And they finally were able to stabilize him with his bipolar situation.
On April 12th, 2010, I was flown back to the United States. I was thinking that the marshals would meet me at the airport and take me into custody, that I was going to have handcuffs on me by the end of the flight. They paged me as I came into the airport. They said, you have a wheelchair waiting. Please see, the agent at this boarding. They had this social worker and a psychiatrist at the airport. They received me, processed me, wheeled me right through customs. I never went through the computer. I never went through immigrations. Picked out my bag. The bag never went through customs. I went through completely without any checking whatsoever. I said, aren't you going to arrest me? I'm not going to be arrested. And he said, no. The charges have been dropped. Very matter of fact, I should have known what was happening. I was amazed. And I said, but this is crazy. I'm a fugitive. I've been 31 years on the lam. And he said, well, I don't know anything about that. They said, that's none of our business. I stayed in the hotel that they put me up in until December of 2010. They set me up with all the medication, appointment with this behavioral clinic, in Miami. I sat at that hotel for 7 months. I mean, it was very lonely, but that was the way it was.
I think it was very difficult at first for people to accept that was back. His relationships with his family members were quite compromised.
I always was with the idea that I could be arrested. Definitely was hanging over my head. It prevented everybody else from interacting with me or me interacting with them, because there was still this specter of fugitivism hanging over my head. My brother came one day
and got him some clothes, a pair of shorts, and they were size 42, and I was like amazed, how big his waist was, his shorts were, couldn't believe that,
Then all of a sudden, one morning, January 27th, 2011, there was a banging on the door at 8:30 in the morning, and there I opened the door. There were three U.S. Marshals and a sheriff's deputy. They said, you're coming with us.
Within several hours, it was all over the news. They made him look like he was some drug kingpin, and it was just so ridiculous, the whole thing.
Oh yeah, and the newspaper, fugitive from law, for 31 years, they finally catch up with him, I mean, come on, that was such a joke. I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it.
And it was ridiculous to think that they had a manhunt for him after 30 years when the man turned himself in. They didn't even want to arrest him. I mean, he offered to turn himself in, and they didn't want him.
I don't really know the truth, but I'm guessing that judge who was still sitting on the bench didn't know that he was back, found out, and they said, whoa, wait a minute. You got to go pick him up.
Being back in the courtroom was not very comfortable. The marshals who escorted me to the courtroom asked me why I ever came back. Why didn't you just stay in South America? The proceeding started. The prosecutor stood up and said to the judge that they had considered the penalty that he should give me, and they said 239 to 278 months of imprisonment would be appropriate. It's 20 or 30 years. At the end of it, the judge said, well, I have already decided what sentence I'm going to give. Count one, 5 years. Count two, 5 years. Racketeering, 5 years. Wire fraud, 5 years. It came out to 33 years. At the end, after I was getting sick, he said, all to be served concurrently. And my attorney whispered to me, said, you know, that's 5 years. So it's the best that could have happened. You know, if of course I had a crystal ball and I knew that they were going to only give me 5 years, I would never have left. I spent 34 and a half months at the minimum security prison before I was released on parole.
When was finally released, we clothed him, we fed him, we took him to the doctor, and he's been doing really well.
Once I went to prison and served my time and came out, everything was different. There's no invisible wall anymore, you know? I mean, it was completely different. People weren't afraid anymore. They knew that it was over.
It removed a stigma.
Yes, I think that it did remove a stigma, being in prison.
Hold on a moment.
It's an airplane.
Yeah.
A plane is half hovering around here.
Yeah, maybe they're looking for you.
Right? They're not. That's the good thing. They're not looking for me. You know, if you'd have said this 6 years ago, I'd have said maybe they are looking for me. Las muchachas de hoy en día.
Special thanks to Max Miller for producing this story, and to Bob Carlson, Carla Green, and the inimitable Nick White, who helped produce and edit the show. Arrivals is produced and sound designed by me, Jonathan Hirsch. Our associate producer is Nora Lind. Steph Tan is our brilliant illustrator, and she produces the art for the show. We are a proud and founding show in the Herd Audio Collective, a group of producers from across North America who have banded together, share resources, and to promote one another's work. More info can be found at the Arrivals website, ARRVLS.com. I'm Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.